CCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Już wkrótce na falach BCFM, Radiowski, audycja w języku polskim. Zaczynamy w niedzielę, 17 maja o godzinie 19.
Coming soon to BCFM, Radiowski, Polish language broadcasting, Sunday at 7 PM.
Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programs so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM, your choice, your voice.
Bank Holiday Sunday, Soul Train and
Panache. Soul Train, this coming Bank Holiday Sunday, May the 24th. Arrive early to guarantee your admission and take advantage of our drink promotions. Admission on £5 with a flyer before 10 PM.
Out, I'm bad.
Warning, this event will be sold out. DJs on the night. Room 1, Mr. Ricky Tutor, hey. Mr. Paul Alexander,
Kude.
Brother Nick.
Bomba.
Room 2,
hey.
Mr. Desi Rankin, Greg Alexander, Flex, special guest, Mr. Dan Ratchet.
Out, I'm bad.
Buy your tickets online at soultrain.co.uk, Bristol Ticket Shop at Panache, All Saints Street, Bristol.
Bullet.
Brought to you in association with bristollistings.co.uk.
BCFM.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Coming up in the next hour, my guests and I will be taking a close look at the recent attempts by Business Secretary Peter Mandelson and others and his friends to sell off the post office. Our economics correspondent Martin Summers is here too to untangle the economic jargon and give his perspective on the week's news. Abroad and the war in Sri Lanka, why have there been so many, reportedly tens of thousands, of civilian casualties? Is the Sri Lankan government fighting crazed Tamil Tiger terrorists, or is it really civil war or revolution? Drive Time's Neil Roberts reports. Eastern Europe and Marina Morris looks at how the economic slump is affecting her home country, the Ukraine. And to wrap up the show, Colin Power and Carl Saxon will be in to tell us about their attempts as laymen to navigate Britain's legal system. But before that is our special Friday Drive Time weather forecast for the next two weekends from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures will be in the high teens, and cloud cover and rain. We have sunny periods and no rain. Winds will be light. Into next week, again, the mid-teens, a little bit cooler than the weekend, quite cloudy, but a rain-free week, pretty much, except for Wednesday. So watch out for next Wednesday's rain. It'll be quite blustery, too, on Wednesday. Next weekend, that's the 30th and 31st of May. It's going to be hot from Friday right through to Monday, and sunny, especially on Friday. Spots of rain on Monday, though. Week after next, warm and high teens, rainy on and off all week, and winds will be light. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight or so from metcheck.com. Well, I'm joined now by author and retired ex of London's New Economics Foundation, also ex-Bristol Debt Advice Centre, Martin Summers, to disentangle some of the jargon and spin in this week's news.
Hello.
So, Martin, can you what's your first story you've got for us this week?
Well, the first story I've got for this week is from The Guardian on Monday, and it says, MPs' expenses, how the scoop came to light. People will be aware that MPs' expenses are very much in the news and everybody's very upset about it, but most people don't realise how the expenses scandal came to light. A hard drive was stolen from inside the Houses of Parliament, which contained the expenses information. And that hard drive was sold to the Daily Telegraph, and the Guardian have uncovered who sold that hard drive to the Daily Telegraph.
So is there any police investigation into this theft?
If you remember, Michael Martin was asking for the police to investigate how this hard drive had ended up in the hands of the Daily Telegraph, but then he was overwhelmed by the scale of the crisis. I'm not for a moment suggesting that MPs' expenses is anything other than a scandal. I'm just talking about how this scandal came to light and why it is coming to light now.
So it sounds like a little operation here to actually grab this hard drive, and then, you know, how much did they sell it? Does it say in the article how much they sold it?
A payment of $300,000 was requested from the Times, but the Times refused to sell. But eventually the Telegraph have bought the hard drive. And, of course, we know who'd get it. It says the intermediary has been named by the Wall Street Journal, the Sunday Times and the Mail on Sunday as John Wick, a former major with the SAS, who is a director of a private security company, International Security Solutions Limited.
But I mean, it doesn't actually matter that much, does it, where this information came from? Surely it's just the facts speak for themselves.
I think it matters because of the timing. What we've got here is some ex-military person running a private security company, presumably with close links to the intelligence services, stealing what is essentially not his information. I mean, if anybody else stole that information under a data protection, they would be prosecuted. I'm not saying that the MP's expenses are not a scandal. They are. But why is it happening now? And I suspect that behind this is not just somebody making money out of this, but that they've been put up to it by bigger forces. Don't forget, the bankers are stealing far more money than the politicians. But we haven't been talking about bankers for the last 2 weeks, have we?
Well, no, people don't elect their bankers, though, do they? I think that's why there's been the focus on the MPs, is because these are our elected representatives.
Well, indeed, but at the same time, elected people, you've got a comeback on them, which is not to vote for them. Bankers, you've got no comeback on them. They've disappeared to Monaco with your money.
So
what's going on.
It sounds like a bit of a murky world, though, this ex-military, ex-SAS people.
Well, it is indeed, and there's another issue there, which is about the privatisation of Britain's military forces. These kind of companies, which are private companies but spun off the army, are very lucrative and are very involved in all sorts of unaccountable activities, like stealing hard drives from the House of Commons, for example.
But this major, I mean, he's entitled to retire from the army, surely, and he's entitled to set up his own little private security business.
Is he entitled to break into the House of Commons and steal stuff, though?
Well, it's an open question. Maybe be hearing more about that. But it is interesting that it's just that one article in The Guardian that looked into that, wasn't it?
Well, no, as I said, the intermediary has been named by the Wall Street Journal, the Sunday Times and the Mail on Sunday. So it's not just a Guardian article, it's just a Guardian article that I've got in front of me.
Okay. Also, I think it was yesterday or maybe the day before, was Independent had an interesting article about the way that MI5 is recruiting Muslims.
Yes, exclusive how MI5 blackmails British Muslims. And the article gives testimony from a number of Muslim men who said that they've been approached by MI5 and told that if they don't work for MI5 as informers, they will be listed as terrorists and they won't be able to travel and they'll be harassed and so on and so forth. So that's what that's about.
So they're saying, basically, work for us or we'll say you're a terrorist.
Yeah, that's what these gentlemen are suggesting.
So what's the implication of that?
Well, it sounds fairly similar to the sort of way informers used to be recruited by the IUC and the army in Northern Ireland. Say you got arrested for some petty offence, they would say, right, we will let you off this petty offence if you cooperate with us as an informer on you know, whoever you think is active as a terrorist in your area. But of course, it's basically entrapment. I mean, you've got a big case now in the US where people are supposedly terrorists. And the FBI set up the whole terror operation. The FBI set up the whole plot, recruited people as terrorists, and then when they've been recruited, said, "Oh, we've caught you all. Now you're all terrorists." So the danger of all of this is that what you're getting is invented terrorism, invented by the security services, who then say, "Oh, we need more money to deal with this." And of course, it's all opaque. So you've got a situation where manipulations of all kinds can go on because the rule of law is being flouted. Essentially, people should not be prosecuted for things unless they are actually planning to do them. They shouldn't be entrapped into stuff and then said, "Oh, you're a terrorist."
So do you think there's an issue here of not enough oversight of MI5? Because the Intelligence and Security Committee, which is part of the Cabinet, are supposed to be stopping this kind of thing.
I think there's a real danger in a sort of state of emergency situation like the one we're in now, that the intelligence services become an overmighty subject. They're not questioned properly. A lot of what they do is secret. They just say, oh, we need more money. We're the good guys. Don't ask too many questions. But I think that's a mistake.
Thanks, Martin. And if you just wait there a little while, we'll be talking to you later in the show about post office privatisation. The Labour privatisation of Bristol's and Britain's post office is now on the horizon. Most men and women are in the front line of this struggle, at least postmen and women are. In a moment, I'll be talking to Kevin Beezer, who represents Bristol's. But first, Marina Morris went out on the streets earlier this week to find out what you think.
I think providing that the Royal Mail Service can continue to provide an effective daily service for the price of a stamp, then they should continue as they are. If they can't maintain that, and it looks like they might not be able to, then they need to look at whatever means are necessary to ensure that we still get the service that we expect.
Definitely not. It's because everything that's been privatised is for profit. What about national, keep everything nationalised, I say. That's me. If somebody else owns it, they've got to make a profit, haven't they? So how do you pay the pension?
Definitely not. Because if you privatise anything, the little people would actually subsidise everything. Fortunately, that was a government who always for a profit, nothing else for anybody else. And we have that exactly the same thing with the railway, with the buses, everything, you know, and it's just not on, you know. Never get the benefit of it. Unfortunately, that was a government who always for a profit, nothing else for anybody else. And we have that exactly the same thing with the railway, with the buses, everything, you know, and it's just not on. I have no sympathy for anything of the privatization anymore. And that's going right across the board.
No, we shouldn't run to it. Just change a government. That would be a big help, wouldn't it? Absolutely, it will happen as well, believe me. Because like we've got in our red shirt, they've got their hands in everyone's pocket, haven't they?
I think it would probably be best to keep it as a public service.
I don't think we should. I prefer it if it is. No, I don't know. It's like the railways, they privatise that and that's gone up the wall. They do need input of money.
No, because my friend's a postmistress and I don't think that's a good idea for her. I don't know, everybody's in deficit.
If they can guarantee that postage is unaffected, ultimately that shouldn't be a problem. For the sort of paying public, there might be greater issues with the spirit of that. You know, a lot of people are very loyal to the Royal Mail. Obviously, there's a lot of people out there that want to know their pensions are secure.
From what I've heard, there's no options. I'd say yes. My heart says no, though. That's better. You probably should privatise so as to get the money in and cover the pension deficit.
Right. That was Marina Morris out on the streets of Bristol, just having a look at what you think about the idea of privatisation of the post office. And I'm joined by Kevin Beezer now, who's Regional Secretary for the Communication Workers Union. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
And you probably noticed Kevin's headquarters as you come down Church Road. You represent the interests of postmen and women right across the region. So roughly how many people do you represent, Kevin?
Including telecom workers as well, because it's just not the postal industry. In the southwest region, it's around 30,000.
Okay, could you just explain, because I think, wasn't it originally separated? So you've got the actual sorting side of the post office originally separated from the post offices themselves. When did that happen and what, you know, how did that
happen? I mean, it happened many years ago in regards to the post office being they were separated as businesses because they used to be able to cross subsidise. So effectively you've got the Crown Office network, you've got Royal Mail, you've got Parcel Force, and many years ago you had TV licensing, which was part of the post office, is now run by Capita, a private company which has got its fingers in many, many companies. Unfortunately, you know, we wanted an integrated postal service, and we had that many years ago under the GPO when it was joined with the telecoms, which obviously subsequently went to BT and then was privatised.
So why is it that do you think that the Royal Mail is still in national hands? Because, I mean, is it the last bit of the old GPO that's still nationalised?
If you look at the way that the post office has been treated by, unfortunately, many governments, including the government we've got at the moment, is they've taken millions and millions of pounds of tax revenue out of the post office and not reinvested. So we're in a situation at the moment where the pensions deficit is very high, but Royal Mail have not paid into the pensions for something like 17 years. The governments of many colours have taken tax revenue out and not put that infrastructure in. So now we hear we've got to modernise. The only way is privatisation, but it's a situation that's not been caused by people in, you know, Royal Mail itself, and especially the workforce. It's a situation being caused by the government.
Yes, but I mean, what we're being told is that these private companies are much cheaper and more efficient.
Well, if you actually look at the figures of these private operators, they're not more efficient, and they're far more expensive. And I think if the privatisation goes through, the likes of TNT or the Belgian Post Office, whoever looks likely to take it over, which we're going to make sure that they don't, what you will get is a worse service and far more expensive service. And anybody looks at utility companies or any company that's been privatised, let's find the ones that are cheaper and more efficient. Everybody knows that that doesn't happen. It's about making money and vast amounts of money for shareholders.
Well, so far, one of the things I've noticed at home is a lot of post is coming through without the traditional stamps on and without even the Queen's head or anything like that. You've got a kind of sort of six-pointed star or something on the, instead of where the stamp used to be. Can you just explain what that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think people need to understand the reason that the post office is in the situation at this moment is because of legislation that ultimately comes through Europe, and that was to liberalise all the postal markets right across Europe so private companies would be able to buy for business. And effectively what you're talking about on those envelopes is downstream access. So those companies in the UK have been able to come in and effectively take the bulk mail, which is always subsidised, you know, the stamp mail if you're sending, I don't know, a postcard to your granny in Scotland. And that's what's kept the prices low. Those private companies now have got into that marketplace where all the profit was in the post office, so you can track the decline in post office profit to the profit of those private companies. Now, what has happened in Europe is, if you look at France, Spain, Italy, Greece, and the countries go on, they have not bought in yet to liberalisation. And if you look at the economics around the world, they're not likely to either. So UK once again is trailblazing.
Well, I'm befuddled there. Why are we doing this in Britain when other parts of Europe aren't? If this is a European directive, surely everybody should be doing it.
Well, I remember a meeting I had about 4 years ago with a government minister when that question was raised, because we believed then, and it's come true, that the UK would end up doing it and nobody else wouldn't. And that minister said that wouldn't happen. It's legislation, and those operators in Europe would follow, and they haven't followed. The question is, why haven't they followed? One, because they've seen the experiment in the UK. I actually attended a conference of trade unions across the whole of Europe, and they're actually sat back watching the UK experiment, they call it, in the postal markets. And what they've seen is a complete mess and possible privatisation, which means increased prices and a worse service, and they're not keen to do it. So you could say that there's people in the UK and the government that are so obsessed with privatisation, they're just going to carry on regardless.
So, but we're being told, and in fact we even heard people on the Vox Pop just now saying that there's no option.
Yeah, there is an option. The option is that we're looking at is the BBC model, the rail track model, and also Welsh Water, where effectively the government puts the money back into the pension fund. We haven't caused that. Government not reinvesting, and also the post office not reinvesting in the pension scheme. It's not our fault that it's in the state that it is. And also, once you do that, that money, once you alleviate the pensions deficit, will free up millions and millions of pounds to reinvest. And therefore, you don't have to privatise the company. Unfortunately, there's people in the government like Peter Mandelson and others that are hell-bent on privatising. You have to beg the question, is it because there may be some share options for those people in the future?
Well, that's an interesting question. Maybe we should ask Peter, see if we can put that one to Peter Mandelson. Now, what does this actually mean for your members, for postal workers on the ground? I mean, we're basically talking about people that go out collecting the mail from the boxes and delivering it and sorting it.
Yeah, our members are really concerned. They're concerned for their pensions, quite obviously, and they're obviously concerned for their jobs, because they know that, you know, it's good knockabout stuff to say to the general public about efficiency, modernisation, which we know, you know, we've lost thousands of jobs over the last few years. We've got new technology coming. We understand that. We're not Luddites. We know there's going to be change. But these people are driving change on the basis of vast amounts of profit. And that means jobs. That means terms and conditions. And if we have a look at TNT, or they're on about selling the post office too, they've threatened their workforce in Holland with a 15% cut because they wouldn't accept changes. And their record on industrial relations and the way they treat their workforce is absolutely appalling. Now, we're talking about a government that want that type of company to take over the good British Post Office. you know, and all they're interested in is massive profits. So the general public think they're going to get with privatisation a better service, a cheaper service, a more efficient service. They won't. They'll get a dearer service and it won't be as good, and those people will make vast amounts of money.
Well, it's easy for you to say, oh, the post office is not going to be so good, but how do you think this is really going to affect ordinary people out there? I mean, at the moment, we haven't really seen much of a difference, just a little bit, the change in the colour of the stamps and the shape of them and things like that.
I think what you'll see by any private company, you've got to ask yourself, in the middle of a recession, why is a private company like TNT and others looking at the post office? If we've got all these problems in the post office, not working efficiently, this, that, and why are they interested? And the question's got to be, because they want to make, you know, they want to make money, and the only way they're going to make it is by putting prices up. How that will affect, it will affect the service. You know, it's still called into question in regards to, will it be a six-day service? What time that delivery people will get to their home addresses, and more importantly for our members, their terms and conditions and pensions, and you know, whether they will get a pay rise or not in the future, which obviously Royal Mail at the moment are saying we're not, will be affected. So that will feed through, but we'll have the analogy, you know, if it does happen in a couple of years, with the general public looking back and going, why did we do that?
So how does this particular privatisation figure in the general TUC or trade union movement? Do you think there are lots of other, do you have support from other unions?
We've got support right across the Southwest TUC. We've got it from every trade union. Ironically, we've got it from the CLPs and the Labour Party, backbench Labour MPs and some Liberal Democrats and the odd rogue Tory. Surprise, surprise. But we've got it right across the trade union movement. Recently at the South West Labour Party conference, we moved a motion and it was unanimously voted on to keep the post office in the public sector. The only ones that don't seem to be listening are the government, and they need to stand up and listen.
But at the end of the day, it's really just about bucks, isn't it? Who's actually got the money to run these things and who's got the political power? So do you think that that's enough, having that union support?
I think it's part of the campaign that we've run in the trade union movement, and also with the general public and the business community. It's not just a trade union issue. You know, I know some of your comments from the general public, some people think, oh, well, perhaps it's the only option. But once we've explained the reasons behind it, they understand and they've supported us. So we've got massive support across the general public, small business community. And we're confident as long as that support keeps growing, and also MPs, that they do the right thing.
Okay, so we're joined again by Martin Summers now. Martin, you were talking a couple of weeks ago, I remember, about the post office being a kind of national bank. What was that about?
Yeah, I mean, we've got to rebuild a banking system which is either publicly or mutually owned, like building societies used to be, or the post office used to be, where when people put their money in, they knew what they were doing, they knew where their money was. It's not being speculated on derivative contracts on the other side of the world. And we need to do that. We need to build, rebuild confidence in the financial system. And something like post office banking would be an obvious way to start doing that. It's reinventing the wheel, of course. I mean, we used to have all of this, but then we privatised it all and got rid of it. We'll have to go back to, you know, and it's really bizarre that people like Peter Mandelson are talking about modernisation as privatisation. That is history. I mean, it's quite possible that TNT haven't got the money to buy post office, to buy what they want to buy in the British Post Office. I mean, and I seem to remember TNT years ago breaking the strike at Wapping and taking all of the Rupert Murdoch's newspapers in and out. I mean, this is, I think Mandelson is out of time, yeah? He's talking about modernisation as privatisation, and that's like yesterday's song. Privatisation as the cure-all for everything has clearly been demonstrated to be nonsense.
So what's going on here? New Labour, we were hearing earlier on, it's the Britain is spearheading the privatisation of the post office in other countries. Why is it a Labour government that's doing this? It doesn't seem to make that much sense.
Well, it's a Labour government which has been co-opted by business interests. I think it's very interesting that nobody else in Europe, everybody else in Europe said, well, you do this first and we'll watch. It's a bit like Afghanistan, you know. You go off and do it and we'll watch.
Well, I'll ask both of you now. Do you think Gordon Brown's got his head round the economics of this?
Well, I don't. I mean, obviously I don't.
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, the type of view that we're getting back from our headquarters is that there is negotiations going on between certain elements of the government, and that doesn't include Peter Mandelson. And the question is what influence we've got and those ministers have got with Mr. Brown, or is Mr. Mandelson and that side of the Labour government going to influence Mr. Brown? I think given, you know, we've got the Euro elections, we've got the general election next year, that he needs to think very, very carefully in regards to just acting on, let's be fair, Peter Mandelson come back from Europe and his job was liberalisation and deregulation in Europe. So, you know, he's just going to carry that mantle on in the UK.
Well, deregulation sounds actually quite good, doesn't it? It's like, imagine, you're not tied down by all these regulations anymore.
Apart from when you mentioned the fact that all of these banks were deregulated, which is why they've gone bust at massive expense to the taxpayer. Regulation, like having rules, is a good thing. Fancy a football match with no rules? Rules are very important things.
Yeah, okay. Kevin, I know you don't represent the sub-post office people, but do you have sympathy for them because we've seen so many closures recently?
Yeah, I mean, part of the campaign is about making sure that we shore up the sub-post office and Crown Office network, especially areas of the southwest, you know, the geography of the southwest, which is reflected in other areas of the country. That needs to make sure that the infrastructure is put in. And one of the things that we've just discussed is about a people's bank, the Post Bank, which ironically used to be Giro Bank before it was sold off. You know, people want to have faith in a banking system that's not corrupt, and the post office is a good start. But we need to see some money from the government on that and some commitment. And, you know, when you're there nationalising banks, it is a bit ironic that you've got an infrastructure, sub-post offices and Crown offices up and down the UK. Why don't they use that outlet?
Martin, before we were chatting just before the show, and you mentioned something about TNT in Holland having financial trouble. Is that right?
Well, they're sacking quite a lot of their people, aren't they? I mean, Kevin will know more than I do about this. I mean, it's quite possible. You see, whole car companies are going bust. You know, big companies are going. TNT might not actually have the money at the end of the day to do what they say they're going to do.
And is that right?
You've got a public infrastructure organisation run by a bankrupt company. You know.
Yeah, I mean, TNT, the same as any logistics company, because of the economic downturn, have got problems. I mean, if you have a look at what they've done in Germany recently, they took over some companies in Germany, and Germany done, I think, quite a good thing in regards to the postal industry. They introduced a minimum wage, so you had the people that work for the post office through the government, and then any private companies, they introduced a minimum wage. And then TNT come in and actually were taken to court in Germany because they were offering lower wages in regards to the euros per hour. TNT at the moment, you know, they are in some financial difficulty, and the question is whether they've got the money. And as I said before, they are trying to dismiss people, and also they said if you don't accept the changes, you're going to get a 15% pay cut. So they're not a particularly nice company, and begs the question of where they've got the money in the first place to actually take parts of the post office off.
What about timescale? I mean, is this something that's hopefully not just going to happen next week? Is it any idea how long it's going to hold, things going to take?
Well, some of the information we had this afternoon is that, you know, we've got the EDM early day motion, we're putting pressure on MPs, it's gone through the House of Lords, it's the first reading apparently has gone through the Houses of Parliament, and we thought the second reading in the Houses of Parliament would be going to be some weeks away. What we've been told, and we've not actually made sure that this is true, so it's only rumours that have come out of the people that we've got in the Houses of Parliament, is that the second reading may be before the Euro elections on June the 5th. And the rationale behind that, which makes no sense to me, is that they'll put pressure on MPs to make sure they vote with the government before the Euro and local elections. And also there may be a cabinet reshuffle before the Euro elections, local elections, to make sure that, you know, they push those changes through. At the same time, we're being told that there is offline negotiations between the union and the government on this issue. So there seems to me to be some sort of, you know, some sort of dispute in the government. You've got the people that really want to talk to us and do some sort of deal because they realise how damaging it will be in regards to our relationship with the Labour government and what the general public think about, you know, the good old post office being privatised. And then you've got the right of the Labour Party / Labour government that want to rush this through Parliament. So the next month, 2 months will be very interesting.
Now, you say the good old post office there. I mean, how does Britain's post office really compare with other post offices around Europe and other parts of the world at the moment?
Well, I think anybody that travels will see the price that is paid in this country and the service they get to realise that, you know, we are a leading light in not just the world but also Europe, and we always have been. Unfortunately, we have had some problems over the last few years, and that's because we've not had the money put into the infrastructure. That said, you only got to look on price and also, you know, the quality of service to realise that we are a good postal service. And it is ironic that our my counterparts in Europe, when they look at the UK postal service, the Royal Mail, that's always been held in high esteem, they scratch their heads and look at the UK government in disbelief that they're on about privatising. You know, let's be fair, at the end of the day, we invaded the postal service. And some of my colleagues in Europe have just saying, yeah, we are watching, and it's very unlikely that we are going to privatise, because we can see what an absolute mess it's going to cause with the National Postal Service.
Do you think there's really a stomach amongst your members up in Filton, for example, with a really big sorting office up there, to take this on, to fight this?
Yeah, I mean, if you just take Filton as an example, which is the biggest mail centre in the southwest, albeit there's a new mail centre or an extended mail centre at Swindon, and they are dotted around the southwest, and delivery members right across the area, people are up for fighting this. I mean, we're not just talking about, you know, Royal Mail as an entity, we're talking about their jobs, their families, their pensions, their terms and conditions, and there is a hell of a lot at stake, and they think it's been used as a political football. They also think, you know, the government aren't telling the truth and trying to get a message across to people about the reasons that we're in this situation. You've got to remember, you know, last year or the year before, we were in financial trouble. The next thing you hear that we're making millions of pounds of profit. People are being less than honest at the top of the post office and in government. Also, it's quite ironic that the government have said, especially Mr. Mandelson, have said, we have not got the right people to run the post office. And yet they were the people that put those people in charge, like Adam Crozier and Leighton, you know, who happens to be the highest paid civil servant to run the post office.
Right. Finally, what can be done? Is anything ordinary people can do out there about this if they feel strongly?
Yeah, there's lots they can do. I mean, the contact their local MP is the first port of call. You know, at the end of the day, I know perhaps people's faith in their MPs is probably a little bit dented with what's going on at the moment, but the democratic process is that anything that will happen to the post office will go through the Houses of Parliament. And to influence that, I would suggest that the general public contact their MP, tell them that they're not happy and they don't want this to happen. You know, the democratic process is to do that, and we would urge people to join our campaign, put pressure on their MP, and whenever they see the campaign, the post office campaign, that they sign our petition. But the most vital ingredient is their local MP, because when that vote comes in the Houses of Parliament to possibly privatise the company, we want to make sure that there's vast amounts of MPs going into the lobby to vote no.
Martin, what do you think? How do you see this panning out in the next few months?
Well, I think it's absolutely symbolic of the wrong direction that the Labour government has gone in over the last few years, and it's a litmus test issue. I mean, this is carrying on down the neoliberal road, and as I said earlier, privatisation is not modernisation. This is 2009. That's old think. We're past that now. It's about building stable infrastructure. So that people can be confident, for example, that when they put their money in an institution, that it's safe. And we need to rebuild confidence in all of our institutions, but not through privatisation. That's a nonsense.
Martin Summers and Regional Secretary for Bristol Communication Workers Union, Kevin Beezer, thanks very much. And Martin will be back to do it all again next week. Video footage from Sri Lanka in the Indian Ocean has shown armed soldiers literally herding great crowds of civilians around at gunpoint. This seems to be one of the characteristics of the so-called war on terror that we've seen more than ever, the military training their guns against disorganised militias and civilians. Mike Zaire is a Somerset gardener who lives near Norton Subhampton, and he spent much of his early life as a tea planter in, as it was then called, Ceylon. He happened to be back in Jaffna in early 1983 when the Tamil rebels killed a truckload of Sri Lankan army conscripts. This attack sparked the Sinhalese backlash, and earlier this week I spoke to Mike Zaire.
I think the first significant significant casualties to the Sri Lankans was when they ambushed a lorry of recruits, they were conscripts, and killed many of them, and one of the people who were killed was a sports superstar. You know, this is equivalent to Beckham or something.
So this was an ambush by the Tamil Tigers?
Yep. On a Sri Lankan convoy going up in Jaffna area.
So do you know what year that was?
That was 1983 in July. possibly 22nd, possibly 21st of July, because on the 23rd of July, Colombo and much of the country, when they heard the news, erupted. And the Sinhalese went on the rampage, killing Tamils all over the place, and many thousands were killed. And it's actually a day that I also got injured, because I knew that where I was living, there was a cultural centre for the Hindus called the Ramakrishna Mission House. And I thought, oh gosh, like I knew something had gone wrong. There was pillars of smoke going up everywhere, cars being burnt, buses being burnt. And when I went and saw it at the Ramakrishna Mission House, there was a jeep on fire, a mini bus on fire, and a coach on fire. But there was only six people doing the damage. So I went in and confronted them. And I say, I got injured, and they probably thought they'd kill me. I was unconscious on the ground with a head wound. So they left the place exactly as I last saw it. So when I came out of hospital a fortnight later, I could see, well, they didn't do any more damage. But from then onwards, really, that's the date.
They were Sinhalese, were they?
They were Sinhalese, who just, there was a lot of Tamils living throughout the country, and certainly a lot in Colombo, and they weren't all supporters of the terrorists at all.
So why do you think there is such a divide between the Tamils and the Sinhalese? This is actually something, because for many years they lived peacefully together, didn't they, in Sri Lanka?
Well, they did, from 1815, when the British went off and killed their king in Kandy and ruled the country and during the time of the English ruling it. Yeah, like often in other places, divide and rule and give the minority a certain amount of civic power. And there were far more Tamils proportionately in the civil service than there were Sinhalese. One of the differences, and they've said this themselves, is that the Tamils are very ambitious. They like making money. They like acquiring power. And the Sinhalese don't, to the same extent. They like to live a Buddhist life, much more quiet, much more relaxed, much more holistic, you could put it that way. And they're certainly not quite so rigid in their attitude to the caste system either. Whereas in the Tamil area, the lowest caste, they weren't allowed to go into the temple.
So you think it's, to a certain extent, it's a cultural difference between Hindus and Buddhists?
A bit like Northern Ireland and Sri Lanka, because the same size as Ireland. And you could say that the Irish in the south are much more relaxed and into music and a pint and a chat and all the rest of it, whereas the Scottish influence and the fundamentalists from the churches there, they're very much more into order and control and making money.
So do you think it was inevitable that something like this was going to happen, where there was a major conflict between the Sri Lankan government and the Tamil Tigers and sort of fought to the end, the bitter end?
Possibly, but that doesn't mean that there aren't quite often rumours of outside interests. I mean, certainly the Tamil Tigers have been well funded by the diaspora, all the people who were in Canada and America and wherever. They will send money back and they will fight and want to help the people who want to fight for. They don't want to go back and live there, though. Sri Lanka's actually a country which made a lot of efforts to be a socialist country, egalitarian country and all the rest of it. And a bit like Cuba, there are vested interests in the West. They don't want to see socialism work really well. And to try and stop that, one of the ways is to try and cause disruption. And when I was out there, I was surprised how often somebody would say, because I could speak the languages and I was prepared to be at grassroots level, "Do you think the CIA are funding this dispute?" they would say.
Somerset Gardner, who was brought up in Sri Lanka, Mike Zare there, giving his view of the origins of the conflict between the culturally Buddhist Sinhalese and the largely Hindu Tamils. Now, back to the UK, and hundreds of Tamils have been protesting for nearly a month or so in Parliament Square. Drive Times reporter Neil Roberts has been looking at their grievances. Now, Neil, what have you found?
Well, the government of Sri Lanka this week declared victory in its 25-year civil war with the LTTE, Tamil Tiger separatist group. In the past few months, government forces have intensified their war to take control of areas of the island populated by the minority ethnic Tamils. Recent fighting has left 7,000 Tamil civilians dead. Thousands more have been displaced by heavy fighting and held in government-controlled detention camps. Many have been trapped for months inside the conflict zone with little access to food, shelter or medical assistance. Tamils around the world have protested against the Sri Lankan government's actions. In London, there have been huge protests over several months organised by the 150,000-strong British Tamil community. Protesters occupied Parliament Square on several occasions, and British Tamils have staged hunger strikes demanding intervention by the British government. Divisions between Sri Lankan Tamils and the majority ethnic Sinhalese date back to the British colonial rule in South Asia. After independence in 1948, the ruling elite of the Sinhalese majority excluded the Tamil population from power, leading to inequality and social divisions. Tamil Tiger militants took up arms to fight for equality and an independent state. More recently, the Sri Lankan government, which is backed and armed by Britain and other Western powers, has intensified its war on the Tamil Tigers under the banner of the War on Terror. Sri Lanka regards the Tigers as a terrorist organisation responsible for killing civilians. Many Tamils see the Tigers as their only representatives in their fight for equality and freedom. There are around 250 Sri Lankan Tamil families living here in Bristol. We spoke to members of the Bristol Tamil Association about the conflict. They asked to remain anonymous because they fear reprisals against their families back home. I asked them if they had friends and family caught up in the recent violence.
We know a lot of people affected by this immediate problem. And the Sri Lankan government shelling and heavy weapons killing a lot of relatives of our friends in this Bristol area as well. I know a person, he lost his sister and a nephew. And this is all affecting us in a way.
Yeah, so one of our families live in that area, the Venni area. My auntie's families and then uncle's families. So last week I talked to my mom asking about them. And they couldn't get any information from them. And even they don't know, are they dead or alive, or this sort of situation. So personally, it's affecting me on my life here. Every day I'm thinking about that because they are our close relatives, and we don't know what's happened to them.
My cousin and her husband and two children. They came from LTT area to Sri Lankan government's area. They said they don't get food or they don't have any facilities to get a bath. It's very difficult, and always the Sri Lankan army come in there and get the ladies, young girls, and take them away and rape them and bring them back. And all of them were crying, and I can't tell you.
Channel 4 produced a documentary recently. It shows a lot of atrocities by the Sri Lankan army in that internment camps. This is similar to the concentration camp in Nazi Germany. The aim of this protest to educate the British public. They didn't know much about what's going on in Sri Lanka, so the Tamil community think only way to stop these killings by educate or expose the Sri Lankan government's atrocities to the British people and the international community. So all this time the media was covering only the news from the government. There's no independent media in that area covering the war. And the UN is refused access, and ICRC only can take the injured people from there with the permission of the Sri Lankan army. They can't independently view anything. After this war, we are fear that all the Tamils are going to be second-class citizens in that country. British government have a responsibility because of their past in the colonial period. Now, UK Parliament and UK government consider Sri Lanka as a friendly nation, democratic country. But they forgot to mention or take action against the humanitarian crimes against the Tamils in that country.
Solution for this problem is it's not militarily, as every Tamils believe. There has to be a political solution. The war will never end in a peace. So even if LTT defeated this time, there will be another war will happen in Sri Lanka very soon. So, yeah, there is no way out on this unless there's a political solution for Tamils.
And this should be done by the guarantee of the international community. There should be a separate state or separate cantons like in Switzerland or Canada, that sort of thing, with the guarantee of the international community will bring the lasting peace in Sri Lanka.
That was members of the Bristol Tamil Association. For an extended version of that interview, look at the bristol.indymedia.org website next week.
Lovely, Neil. And we'll be hearing more from you next week, I hope, will we?
Yeah.
Thanks. Now, Friday Drive Time reporter Marina Morris is joining us. Marina, I understand you've been looking at how the global financial meltdown is affecting your home country, Ukraine.
Yes. European Union diplomats currently describe Ukraine as the biggest foreign policy challenge of the day. After gross domestic products reached $180 billion in 2008, the economy contracted by 20-25% in the first quarter of 2009. In April, Kyiv's government announced it would nationalize 7 of the country's banks as a part of multi-billion dollars bailout plan. Many citizens of Ukraine are unable to retrieve deposits from the troubled banks. Officials say employment in the country of 46 million could soon double to 2 million. Having grown impressively and strongly after the Orange Revolution in 2004, Ukraine's economic growth has reversed into the worst-hit European economy by the global financial crisis. The Ukrainian economics crisis is in a part of consequences of a political crisis and uncertain direction. Ukraine is becoming the main location of a strategic battle between Russian and European Union over the country's future as an eastern or western facing country. The European Union, the United States and Russia are all vying for influence in Ukraine, which straddle key Russian gas export routes to energy-hungry European Union nations. A long-running political standoff could paralyze the country, but would probably not have many repercussions overseas. The main pipeline delivering Russia gas to Europe passed through Ukraine, but there would not appear to be any threat to supplies at present. Russia is unhappy about what is regarded as West interference and influence in Ukraine politics, and the West is critical of Russia's open support for Ukraine's opposition. At the Praga summit in May 2008 to launch the Eastern Partnership, the 27 nation blocs of the European Union were interested in prioritizing expansion of cooperation with the six former Soviet Union countries in the energy sphere and discussed a project to build a new Caspian-Nabucco gas pipeline at the meeting, which would bypass both Russia and Ukraine, reducing their control over European gas supplies. Russia is not in favor of this project. At yesterday's Russia-European Union summit at Khabarovsk in Russia, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev was warned the European Union not to use a proposed partnership with former Soviet countries against Moscow. He also signaled a new gas crisis may lie ahead, suggesting Ukraine lacks the money to pay for gas Russian providers. Many people in Ukraine are eager to join the European Union club, but consider that the Eastern Partnership Summit in Prague is meddling without offering the Ukraine anything. Without giving Ukraine a real prospect of being European, particularly via of freedoms of travel and work, the European Union risks ending up destabilizing the region further. Ukraine is preparing for election in January 2010 and hosting the Euro 2012 Football Championship. Many people consider themselves squeezed by recession and fed up with poison politics. Ukrainian votes are desperate for a leader to rekindle the lost optimism of the Orange Revolution. A poll by the Ukraine Razumkov think tank center last month suggests about two-thirds of citizens have completely lost trust in Ukraine's current leaders. They are looking for new people who will produce results, improve the economy, and end the political infighting. The Financial Times recently published an article about fresh face wins pro-NATO 34-year-old Arseniy Yatsenyuk as an alternative to the three current leaders whose mudslinging power struggle has dominated Kyiv's politics since 2004. His policies are pro-Western, whilst also seeking to improve relations with Russia.
Thanks, Marina. Now, it sounds like the Eastern Europeans are having things a bit worse than us, but similar stuff as well, because I hear you saying there that the Ukrainians are losing trust in their leaders too. And let's just remember that if the Ukrainian people aren't actually able to get their money, this is a real problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks very much for that, and we'll be hearing more snippets of Eastern European news next week. Time now to hand over to Colin Power, who, as a layman in Bristol, has been doing a practical exploration of the British court system and getting to put in prisoners too for his trouble.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Good evening to the Legal Minefield. I'm Agent Power, and I'm joined here today by
Kyle Saxon.
That's it. Now, we've been variously, obviously, looking into some of this stuff. I think we went through the person thing, didn't we, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, we've been through the person and how it's a corporation with your state-given title and your name in all capital letters, and that's all they can act on.
Yeah, and that's it. And it actually turns out that, you know, it's all a one big corporation. Yeah, that's it. You know, United Kingdom Limited, there you go. And we sort of recommended, you know, go and check on Dun & Bradstreet. Now, just to confirm, for those of you who have been looking, you have to go to the .com, really, and look on the international site. And if you do, you will one of the interesting corporations that we've been looking into has been a corporation called Southwest One, part of IBM United Kingdom Limited. It's sort of registered at the same address. If you go and look on there, 40 PO Box 41 in Portsmouth, Caution, something like that. Anyway, interestingly enough, there's been a guy who's been speaking out about it. His name is Mr. Ian Liddell Granger. I think I got that right.
Granger, yeah, that's
Granger,
right.
Granger, yeah.
Ian Liddell Granger.
There
he's
we are.
An MP for Bridgewater.
That's the guy. That's the one. Now, very, very pleasant chap. Sort of had a little look at his website and things like that, and he has this to say about Southwest One.
Southwest One is a joint venture company set up by Somerset County Council, Taunton Deane Council, and now including Avon and Somerset Police. It is a huge and risky venture. It could cost taxpayers $400 million. I believe there has been excessive secrecy about the negotiations to form it, justifiable suspicion about the roles of several leading players, and a totally unrealistic business plan. Not that I have ever seen the business plan, not that a single elected councillor of any party has ever seen the business plan either, or the contract. What a way to run a council. I made a parliamentary speech about the subject on March the 26th. Since then, the chief executive, Alan Jones, has been smarting, suggesting that if I dared say the same thing outside the House of Commons, I would risk being sued. Okay, Mr. Jones, the speech has been on this website ever since, so where are the writs?
There you go. So, hasn't received one yet. But anyway, just a little bit more. IBM is actually going, according to Mr. Granger, will be actually owning 81% of this business corporation. Now, just to give you a kind of balance of how things work, I mean, IBM last year turned over $98 billion US dollars and made a $10 billion US dollar profit. Not that actually the dollar, you know, might not mean that much nowadays. There you go. But anyway.
You're just jealous, Colin, aren't you?
That's it, all those dollars, eh? And basically, one of the on the side of the public, we have one person who's normally in charge of Taunton's car parks, and the other who strums in the Yeovil jazz band. He actually sort of says here that, you know, both would be baffled by a balance sheet. So there is a sort of question over as to whether how fair this sort of business contract might well be. Southwest One is destined to gobble up more than $400 million in public money, providing just two councils with services over the next 10 years.
Well, it all started with something called ISIS. Nothing Masonic about that whatsoever, I'm sure. Just complete coincidence. But this started a few years ago, and it was improving services in Somerset. And the project manager for that was a woman called Sue Barnes, who apparently had excellent qualifications and substantial experience in local government. Again, purely total coincidence. She just happened to be married to Mr. Colin Port, who's the chief constable of Avon and Somerset Police.
So basically, the they sort of set up this unitarily plan, driven by one dangerous and very determined individual. His name is Alan Jones, so do give him a quick, write him a quick letter and find out a little bit more about what his plans are for Southwest One and how it all works.
So some more resources if you want to tune into this sort of stuff. Dun & Bradstreet, remember to go to the American site, you won't find that much good stuff on the UK site. Again, if you're into the Freeman thing, you want to find out more about the person, if you do the Facebook, then go on the Freeman Society. TPUC will soon have all this stuff covered. The Anti-Terrorist is an excellent resource, and there's also Rob Menard and a whole bunch of stuff out there as well.
And lastly, just say thanks to all those people who turned up to the Trinity last Thursday for John Harris's amazing talk there. Absolutely rammed, standing room only. We had some of the police down there as well, so thanks a lot, guys, for coming down. Actually, you know, we actually love you guys, so you know, don't worry, you're thinking, you know, we're sort of getting in your way there or anything.
So is that you reviewing your own event there, saying...
That was us reviewing our own little event there. Yeah, yeah. Not that we're biased, but I must say it was a very, very friendly atmosphere and you know, a lot of love going out there.
Can you just tell, for anyone that didn't know about it or wasn't there, you know, in a nutshell, what were you doing?
Well, basically, John Harris has served some affidavits to the Queen and has been looking into the legal service and the lawful processes of this country and, well, the process of the world, actually, and has uncovered some amazing information. One of the most amazing facts that I found out about was actually that the Ministry of Justice, trading as Magistrates' Courts, is actually a for-profit corporation and has been for the last 450 years.
I think if anyone's ever sat in a courtroom and watched the proceedings, there'll be no doubt whatsoever that the entire purpose of it is to wring some cash out of you and pack you on your way.
Yeah, they might need to squeeze a little blood out on the way, but that's just the way it goes.
I don't think this is the case for every single court case. I mean, surely sometimes it's literally a dispute between the Crown and some ordinary person, isn't it?
Well, that's Crown Court. I haven't been there yet, so I can't comment. But the Ministry of Justice, trading as Magistrates Courts, is definitely a for-profit corporation.
And it would appear that justice does mean just us, not you lowly peasants.
But apart from that, obviously, no legal advice there whatsoever. So do keep your eyes open and try and act in peace at all times is our message.
And if you want some more information on Southwest One, then you can go and watch West Eye View, Public Money, Private Gain, Privatisation of Southwest Government by ITV.
I think it's a good idea just to reiterate that you two are laymen. You're not trained in legal advice, are you?
God, no.
No, we're just men on the land.
Thanks very much. We'll be hearing more from you two next week, I hope. Well, it's nearly 6 o'clock. That's all we have time for this week. Join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM, where we'll be doing our level best to analyse the less well-reported events in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you've got suggestions for future shows, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Next week we take a look again at Bristol's council houses. Why is Bristol City Council leaving quality prefabs in idyllic Snaid Park unoccupied for several years, despite 20,000 or so homeless people wanting to rent them? Thanks to our reporters Marina Morris and Neil Roberts. Economic analysis and review of this week's other news was by Martin Summers, and the Legal Minefield reporters were Colin Power and Carl Saxon. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and long weekend. We have roughly 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres, so while it might feel sometimes there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because soulless corporations and the super rich have taken far more than their share. All we have to do is make sure that the 60 million